London was closed today after protesters threw food at a display case containing the imperial state crown. Four people were arrested. A group called Take Back Power said its members smeared apple crumble and yellow custard on the case. The group wants the government to tax the extremely wealthy. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Legacy Box, committed to helping preserve moments that matter this holiday season by digitizing videos and photos, then storing them in the cloud so they can be gifted for generations to come. LegacyBox.com.
Well, it is a chilly morning here on the Augustana College campus, but friends, you're just in time for a cozy conversation with this week's guests, Kelly and Tammy Rundle from Fourth Wall Films. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll join us here on WVIK for local radio the way it's meant to be brewed on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. Okay, this is one of those episodes where I have to give a little bit of a warning in advance. I am a huge fan. So if I start to fanboy out on Kelly and Tammy Rundle, I hope you'll just all forgive me for that. But I have loved your work for a long time. So, Tammy, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And Kelly, thanks for being with us this morning.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. See, we wanted to establish those different voices. So as we're talking,
sure.
Right.
We know what's going on. No, I do. You are wonderful filmmakers. You have chosen topics unfailingly that even if I don't know they're near and dear to my heart, after I watch the film, I realize then they are near and dear to my heart. But I think, and we'll get into all the filmmaking in just a little bit. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. To start at the very beginning, I usually ask my guests where you grew up, and so that's going to lead right into the two of you, when you guys actually met and all that sort of stuff. So who wants to take the lead on where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Waterloo, Iowa. Uh-huh. I was born and raised there, and Kelly was basically grew up in the Quad Cities.
Yeah, born in Wisconsin, but moved here halfway through first grade, so this is where I grew up. Yeah, graduated from United Township High School.
All right. Now, UT has a variety of different elementary districts. Which part of the UT universe did you grow up in?
Hillcrest.
Oh, sure.
And then Glenview.
All right. Okay. Yeah. And we give you props because it's a wonderful thing when a quad citizen is able to import talent, you know, so you got the, you managed to get Tammy here from Waterloo. But how did you guys meet?
Well, we met at a summer camp.
Oh.
I was a camper mm-hmm. and he was a counselor.
All right. And is getting good already.
Yeah. Nah, not quite as salacious as it sounds. But
oh, sure it was. Come on, we got to make this interesting.
Hey, man.
It was back then. It felt.
Oh, of course.
I was just head over heels. I saw him and I was like, oh, this is the one. And I was only 17 years old.
Oh, my. Yeah. And where was the camp? I got to know.
Iowa. Yeah, Mechanicsville. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
all right.
Just
okay.
A small camp.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Summer camp.
I'm thinking about the future Hallmark movie already.
Oh, yeah. Gosh.
So then that was, did that tie you guys together? Did you guys like go off to college together or did you get separate and then back together? I need all the gory details.
Well, I first want to say that I had never met until that moment a girl who had been making films with her father's, you know, movie camera, yeah. Like I had been doing. So that caught my attention right away. But
he proposed to me after 2 weeks.
Get out.
No,
no,
he did.
And we were both in kind of committed relationships when we met. So long-term relationships.
Talk about a two-week notice.
Yeah. So it was a little bit like lightning.
Well, I
striking.
Like it. Yeah.
Oh, this is great. I had no idea we were going to stumble onto this epic story here.
Well, you did ask.
So, all right. So, Tammy, you were 17. Kelly, were you still in high school, in college? Where were you at this time?
I was graduated from high school.
UT.
I was a Black Hawk College student. Mm-hmm. I was kind of uncertain about what to do in terms of a career. I was an art major at Black Hawk,
which has a great art department, always has.
Yeah, and I did intro TV stuff there.
Yeah.
But I just didn't know what I was going to do and kind of floundered around a little bit in terms of college right away.
Yeah. And perfectly fine.
So I had accumulated, 2 years worth of college credits, I guess. And then Tammy and I got married in 1980, so we had a one-year engagement, and
I had to graduate.
Of course, right.
She did have to graduate. But then we decided, 3 years later, we were going to move to the Kansas City area. Oh. Tammy was going to start school, and I was going to finish. And so we attended Park University.
Oh, yeah, I know it well.
And Park has a similar feel to Augustana. Yeah. You know, the campus does. It's probably a similar vintage.
Yeah. Their assistant to the president is a friend of mine. There is this, if you're familiar with the film Grand Budapest Hotel, there's a great scene where all the concierges know each other. Well, secretly, all the president's assistants in colleges and universities know each other. So we have our own secret network. Yeah, right. That's how I know Park.
Right.
So,
it was
cool.
A small group, a campus, and they had a great communication arts program, which is why I wanted to go there.
Mm-hmm.
So I studied broadcasting and radio, TV, film, and journalism.
And I was interested in writing. I would tell people, I'm majoring in English, and they'd be like, oh, all right, that sounds...
Yeah. How many CEOs of great corporations were English majors? I mean, come on. Yeah,
you have to be able
never
to
apologize for that. Absolutely.
And it has served us well with,
our
work.
You said something very intriguing. You were into filmmaking even earlier. So is this like Super 8, 16 millimeter cameras? What kind of? Tell me about that.
She was regular 8. I was Super 8.
All right.
My parents were good enough to let me monkey around with their camera.
Yeah.
And I would babysit. And I wasn't your typical, high school student.
Mm-hmm.
I was saving up my babysitting money to purchase film. That's what I was doing.
Right.
I wasn't buying the fashions and all that stuff. That's what I was interested in. And you would never see these. I will never show them to anybody. But it was just kind of discovering and exploring how to make films and how to edit films.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you did the same thing.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, the reason I'm intrigued by that is I went to Rock Island High School, and there was a great teacher. He's still around in town, Charles Astrike, and he taught a film class at high school. And there was a cadre of fellas. I was never nearly as creative as they were, but they were making movies. And same thing, any spare dime they had, other guys were trying to get into drive-in movies. They were going up to Jewel Osco to get it developed, and that was the only place that, right? Okay. So... Well, then they went off to SIU and wound up being part of a Student Academy Award Best Documentary, which was a documentary on Norma Jean Elephant in Oquaka.
I have seen that film.
You've seen that one. Great.
And we've also been to the Student Academy Award ceremony once.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
And then that was the main producer of that was John Behnke. And then later, for their senior project, they made a silent film that was very much inspired by Buster Keaton, but not it was more. Now I'm going to blank on it. The guy who's hanging from the clock,
Norman Lloyd.
Harold Lloyd.
Harold Lloyd. That's right.
Lloyd.
It's a team effort. Harold Lloyd. Thank you so much. And it happens that my friend in this case, Rob Humphrey, at that time it really bore a bit of a resemblance to Harold Lloyd. But they won. And it was best picture for the Student Academy Awards in about, 88, 89. But and thanks to WVIK and Don Wooten, we got to screen it in big screen at Centennial Hall, many, many years ago. And it was a riot. But it all started with that kind of creativity. So I have great interest in folks whose creative outlet was started with 8mm film. That's fantastic. When then, though, did it start to become apparent that this might be something? You said, Kelly, that you were sort of struggling for what to do. When did this start to, no pun intended, come into focus?
Mm. Well, I made my first documentary, historical documentary film in junior high school. It was one of those big topics. It was the Civil War.
Wow.
Lasted a few minutes. The teacher loved it so much that we spent an entire day showing it to every class, including the principal, who was not impressed because the film contained some satires. He was not amused, did not have a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, that happens.
But in college, my thought was broadcasting is, I understood that to be a more practical approach. And so I was studying broadcasting, studying journalism. But in my off hours, I was consuming everything I could find on cinema. And we were watching a lot of movies. And so I was pursuing that as a sideline, I guess you'd say.
Yeah. Well, kudos to Ken Burns for having the chutzpah to take on the Civil War after Kelly Rundle.
It's true. You know, I hit it first. He did a
definitive opus.
He did do a better job. I have to admit.
Well, and I will say I'm only about two episodes into the Revolutionary War, which I bet you guys have just
fantastic.
Yeah, I mean it's just. Wow, what a masterclass he gives every time he does something like that. So it's phenomenal. But we'll get into your style and your storytelling in a minute. But what I've always liked is yours is very distinctive too, and distinctively not something that you'll see in a lot of other filmmakers. So starting from the Civil War, but again, when did that corner turn where it was would lead to fourth wall films?
Los Angeles.
Yeah, it started a little bit in Kansas City in the sense that I was doing some freelance work and using, I think initially we used Fourth Wall Productions as just kind of the name.
Mm-hmm.
But in Los Angeles, I got a job with Columbia Pictures and worked there for 7 years. And so I had this inside view of movie making. And I think when we first went, I had the notion perhaps I would work in the film industry in some formal way. But there was maybe 3 years into my time there, I realized that the studio was only making maybe two or three pictures a year that I was really proud of, you know, that I was associated mm-hmm. in some small way.
Mm-hmm.
And that the opportunities to direct something that would be meaningful are very, they're few and far between.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tammy and I began talking about producing something independently. And we explored or developed three different topics, and they were all historical documentary mm-hmm. topics. And that's what led us to producing our first film, Villisca, Living with a Mystery.
All right. Now, we've got to dwell on that a little bit. A lot of people may not recognize that name, but they're going to recognize the mystery. So tell us about that film.
Well, we are trying to remember how we came across that topic, but the person we ended up working with, Dr. Ed Epperle, we were back here. I was earning the BIX.
Oh,
this is why we were living in Kansas City, and I did the BIX 7 times, and it was one of those times. And in the afternoon afterward, we were watching local TV,
mm-hmm.
and there was an interview with Dr. Ed Epperle, and he was talking about the 1912 Villisca axe murders. That's how we found out about it. And so at the time, we called the station, got his name, and that he was a professor at Luther College in Decorah.
Yeah.
And had that on a little piece of paper for years. I mean, it was several years.
File folder. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what we pulled out, was that as one of the topics. We didn't know much about the story, but just knew that it was kind of an enduring and fascinating mystery.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't interested necessarily in the gore and all the horror and that kind of thing. We really were interested in how this, tragedy transformed this little town and split the town and, really had an impact on Iowa history, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we decided, okay, we're going to do this independently, and took off, and it took us 10 years to complete that film. We shot it on 16mm. This was before digital, and that's kind of how we got started.
Wow. I didn't know that that was the first one that you did. And I am suddenly reminded that, you know, I'm very happy to have Kelly and Tammy Rundle here from Fourth Wall Films, but this is the WVIK end of year fund drive. Now, friends, you may have heard that the federal government was playing a little fast and loose with commitments they had made, and all of a sudden, in the middle of a budget year, WVIK was informed it was losing about $147,000. So that's why we're doing this fund drive and asking you to be cognizant of the kind of storytelling that you've come to know here. And so we want to thank Chris and Randy from Clinton, who are checking in on the fund drive, noting that they love classical music. Well, Chris and Randy, so do I. We're grateful to them and to Mary and Lee from Davenport, whom I also happen to know likes classical music. Great to hear from you, Marion. A friend from DeWitt, Ted Sandrock from Bettendorf has checked in. You can too. And our friend Amber is right across the hall right now, 309-794-7500. If you'd like to speak to a live human being and become part of the WVIK Fund Drive, you can also go online at wvik.org. Now, right now, we're talking about, we're getting into this notion of storytelling. And friends, we're very proud here at WVIK that we've been able to once again provide a home for one of our community's greatest storytellers, Roll Tweet and Rock Island Lines. And this is a time every week where we step aside for just a moment and see what Doc Tweet might have had up his sleeve for us this week. Here's Rock Island Lines.
This is Roll Tweet on Rock Island. A few days ago, I stopped in at a New Age bookstore and coffee house near Rock Island to browse. On one shelf, I found a map of the world marking all the sacred places, those mystery spots on this globe where there is a convergence, where the energies sweeping the universe reach down and touch the earth. The Alki Valley in Chile was on the map, a thin slit of green in the Atacama Desert, where the poet Gabriela Mistral was born, South America's first Nobel laureate. Now three communes have gathered near that convergence to drink in its forces. The map listed many of the Inca ruins in Peru. Peru seems to have cornered the market on sacred places. Several years ago, I watched a busload of New Age tourists opening themselves to the Inca stones at Machu Picchu, the lost city of the Incas high in the mountains. Nearby, a family of Quechua Indians herding three sheep, a pig, and some chickens seemed mildly amused. But I noticed that the book has missed our sacred spot, the one near here. 14 miles upstream from Rock Island, the Mississippi River has its own convergence. It is a 3-acre green circle in the river. You must come here just before sunrise in May, for only in that month do the paths of the sun and the river channel meet in a spectacular harmony. Bring others with you, for these energies must be shared. Build a small fire, heat some coffee, and wait. Make only the smallest of small talk. At about 5:30, the sky will brighten and pink. Stand then and look up the channel, and watch the sun edge over the low bluffs, ignite the world, and turn the water to a molten red accompanied by a chorus of birds from the woods nearby. Moses had no more burning bush than this. 10 minutes, and it's over, but it's enough to last the year. I understand why a New Age geography might have missed our spot. In true Midwestern fashion, we do not call it a sacred space. We call it Lock and Dam 14.
Rock Island Lines with Roll Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And we get to hear it each and every week because of folks just like you who've become members of this radio station. Remember, if you do during our end of year fund drive, you've got a shot at one of these really cool t-shirts. It says Power to the Public. It's got WVIK and NPR's logos on it. And if you were to make a sustaining gift of $10 a month, you get the nice short sleeve tee. At $15 a month, you get a pretty handsome long sleeve tee. And if you want to splurge and say $20 a month, that's $240 for the entire year. And $20 about is about how much I spend on good coffee, I think, at places around here. You get a wonderful sweatshirt, all with Power to the Public on it, and you have the satisfaction of knowing that you're maintaining things like Rock Island Lines with Rolled Tweet on public radio. And I just did a little bit of math. We are just $182 from the next $1,000 plateau. So maybe in the course of time of this hour, if you call 309-794-7500, we can reach that plateau and move on. And what a great day for a story like that when my guests are two amazing storytellers, Tammy and Kelly Rundle from Fourth Wall Films. And friends, before we get too much further into this, tell us about that name, Fourth Wall. Where did that come from, and what was attractive about it to you in your work?
The name came to us as we were on Interstate 35 heading south to back to Kansas City. I suppose we were up here for a visit. And because of my awareness of Tammy's involvement in theater in college, she was a choreographer and a
stage manager.
I became aware of the term. And so in the theater, the fourth wall is the missing wall on a stage. But we look at it a little bit differently. We're in a theater, if you will, and the fourth wall is the wall that the film is being projected on. And so for us, it's the interface between the performance and the audience.
Okay. Now, in thinking about today's conversation, I was reminded, and this is pretty obscure, but like most products of public education of my era, we read Fahrenheit 451. Uh-huh. And do you remember that she was surrounding herself, Montag's wife was generally closing herself off from the world with these screens.
Yes.
And her greatest aspiration was to complete it and get a fourth wall so she would have no touch with reality at all.
Okay.
No, I know yours has nothing to do with that.
Right.
Had that ever occurred to you?
No, that's very disturbing, though.
We just
though.
Watched that not too long.
Did you really?
Yeah, we watched
yes.
the film, yeah.
The original, the way back one, the black and white one that they did?
No.
No, this
is
more
was
recent
the
one? Truffaut
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. I think that's okay. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They showed that to us as well.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I knew what you guys were, and that's one of my favorite aspects of theater. And having grown up doing a lot of Shakespeare with Genesius Guild,
right.
I mean, he never really takes advantage of it. There's prologue in Henry V and some others like that where they will occasionally, and of course, Puck at the end of Midsummer Night's Dream. Now, pardon, gentles, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
Lend me your hands if we be friends. It is a very effective device. And I like the way you put it, though, that it's also being mindful of your invitation to us to be in the story.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So we start with crime, but not from a true crime perspective. What were some of the other, were these other ideas you were talking about? Where did they start to hit the road?
Yeah. And before we leave that,
it
definitely was the true crime. I mean, it is a true crime film, but as Tammy said, it also explores the way that crime distorted a community, both when it was happening and being investigated, but then over the decades. So the story for Villisca begins maybe prior when the city became a city, and it doesn't end until the present day we were working in. So we were telling a very big story about that true crime. But what we do when we're looking for a topic, and I most often it feels like the topic came looking for us.
Right, that's
but
true.
We're looking for stories that have a local or regional awareness, but deserve a much wider audience.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our...
And that's quite a thread. I mean, some of the other movies, and I don't want to... Well, we'll give a little bit of an index here, but I was very much touched by your taking on the story of Atanasoff and the computer. And did you not show that in Wallenberg? Or am I blanking on
something? Yeah, so that was... through our nonprofit Truth First Film Alliance, we were a sponsor.
Oh, you
for
were
that
a sponsor
event.
Of that.
Right.
So you guys were not the producers of that.
Correct.
But I remember
correct.
Seeing you at that one. So,
yeah.
And that's the kind of storytelling that you guys do. Yeah. But Fourth Wall, though, this is the one that intrigues me. Did you guys not take on Peshtigo?
Our current work in progress.
Okay. So I didn't think it had come out, but I am so grateful for that because my mother was from Escanaba in the UP.
Okay.
So couple of times a year, summer, winter, you know, when my grandparents were living, we would drive through Peshtigo.
Yes.
Right.
And it's a little bit sad that now US 41 has gone on a bypass around Peshtigo, but tell us a little bit without, well, you won't give away too much.
Right.
No
right.
spoiler alerts here.
Right.
But tell us about the story that you're telling and what attracted you to it?
Well, Kelly grew up, you didn't grow up in, he was born in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And so I think you kind of tripped upon that story online.
I did.
Didn't you?
On YouTube. I don't even remember how I got
really?
To it.
Yeah.
But like most people, certainly there are some people, but most people have never heard of the Peshtigo fire.
You hear about the Chicago fire.
Of course.
Right.
So which happened on the same day.
That's the thing. And there were other fires on the same day. So most people don't know that. But the Peshtigo fire remains the most deadly wildfire in recorded history.
Mm-hmm.
So there were up to 2,500 people that perished in that fire.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of million acres burned. And because it happened on the same day as the Great Chicago Fire, even people in Wisconsin didn't know about it.
Right.
So you had state legislators and the governor of Wisconsin, for example, putting together trains of aid and support for Chicago. And off they were on their way to Chicago when word came in the way of a written note saying, you know, everything's burning up, send help kind of thing. And that was received by the governor's young wife. And so she's actually the one who began the process of sending aid to Peshtigo rather than Chicago.
Yeah. And Peshtigo, if you can picture, friends, in your mind's eye, the map of Wisconsin, you've got the Door Peninsula sticking off. Peshtigo's on the mainland, if you will. But this fire was so intense that it caught woods on the Door Peninsula. It went over Green Bay, landing there. And the fire, because Peshtigo was a wood mill, a sawmill town.
There was lumber town,
so much dust, sawdust, that it sort of prefigured the fire bombings that you saw in World War II, that I understand it was, the fire was so intense it just ripped the oxygen out of the air. And people who were not necessarily burned yet died of suffocation being out in the street because the oxygen was simply gone.
Right.
And even if they jumped in the Peshtigo River and were trying to save themselves that way. So just a horrendous thing. And I'm grateful that you're lifting it out of obscurity.
Well, and there are two elements to it. One is the human element, mm-hmm. which is these smoldering fires and things from clear cutting, and the streets paved with sawdust in Peshtigo. And
mattresses stuffed with sawdust.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Everything. They used everything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there was also a regional wind event, and that is what created,
a firestorm.
Yeah.
The situation that occurred. And the people, survivors, few as they were, described something like a tornado made of fire.
Yeah. Because it altered the weather patterns.
Yes.
Right?
When you look at it, I didn't realize people were looking at weather that early.
Mm.
This is 1871. But there's a guy who did a weather map that looks very much like sort of modern maps, but you can really see the event was a huge windstorm in the upper Midwest.
Hmm.
It was devastating, completely wiped out the town.
Right.
There was nothing left. I think, right?
And if you're heading north out of Green Bay, you can still take that exit and see a nice museum that's there.
Yes.
What's unusual about it when you first arrive at Peshtigo is that the city sign has the word Peshtigo on it, as you would expect, and below are flames licking at the letters.
Yeah.
And it makes you wonder for a second, what's happening here? Because it just feels a little strange at first. But their perspective is the city is like a phoenix. It's come back from the ashes.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
they celebrate that. But they also, for example, this year we were up there in October for the commemoration that they do every year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite touching. And there are accounts from victims that they read, and there are candles, and it's at night, and the church bell rings, and so on. So
and the cemetery has, of course, mass graves mm-hmm. right behind the church. Mm-hmm. That museum you were talking about.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's on the one hand, we still go every year. We go up to the UP and we drive mm-hmm. now the bypass. And part of me is grateful because in my childhood it was two-lane. Deer swarming dark roads with the woods coming right up. So I like the convenience of a four lane that goes around, but right. I just wonder how many people drive past there and they have no idea the history that they're going right past and not having a chance to see.
Well, that's the shocking thing, too. They have a tremendous amount of visitors from all over the world.
Cool.
Every year.
Yeah.
Thousands.
So
thousands.
I was surprised.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people seek it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, your films do some interesting things. I mean, some of them we get to see in special screenings. Some of them we can see on public broadcasting. Yay, PBS. But some are kind of made for museums. And I don't know, is that how the IOA started, or was, tell me, I just love the way you guys had this great relationship, continuing relationship with the Lost Nation of the IOA. So please tell me about that one.
Well, we came to the IOA as a topic through someone who saw our first film, Villisca Living with a Mystery, mm-hmm. and knew someone who had connections to the IOA tribe as a friendship type connection. Mm-hmm. And so we looked into it and realized right away this was an important
Iowa
Midwestern
story,
and
else.
Iowa history mm-hmm. story, but an important American history story that had been kind of forgotten, we thought. So we did make a film about, a one-hour film about the Iowa, and we shot that before we moved from L.A., and then we moved. We logged 20,000 highway miles making that film over two
from
years.
LA,
so we thought if we're going to keep making Midwestern films, maybe we should be in the Midwest.
Love the power of economics.
So we moved, we finished that film and premiered it. And then we were traveling with that film throughout the Midwest for months. People were really interested in it.
Oh, yeah.
But the most common thing that people said was because the film had a, you know, in an hour you have to have a limit. So
PBS hour.
Mm-hmm.
People wanted to know what happened after that, you know, where the story ended. And so we did end up making two additional one-hour films that completed a full story that begins around 1600 and ends in the 1970s.
Hmm.
So that's how we got to the museum film you may be thinking of, Good Earth, Awakening the Silent City in Sioux Falls.
All right.
We did that one, and now we're getting ready to work on Black Hawk, a visitor film for Black Hawk.
The State Historic Site.
Yes.
Yep.
Which
wonderful.
We're thrilled about.
Wonderful. Yes. Wonderful. Yeah, I'm anxious to see all these come to fruition, but growing up in Rock Island, you take a special interest in Makatai Meshekyakyak and his wife, Ashewekwa, and their kid, Nasa Askuk.
Hey. Yes, very.
And it strikes me that they have such an influence on who we are and our identity today. But the Sauk people were not here much more than about 100 years. Mm-hmm. And it was, of course, a forced migration brought on by pressure from Europeans in the East. They originally were from around Ontario, lower Michigan, around Lake Huron more, and then came to our neck of the woods and displaced people to do so. But I'm captivated by Sauk cosmology, sociology, anthropology, and I'm really looking forward. That'll be great.
Yeah, we're in the early stages of research, so development and pre-production, mm-hmm. and hope to be into production next year.
Yeah, definitely will be.
But do tell us about this genre of place-based films, where you're going to go to a site, and you know that's one of the places you can experience it.
Well, let's take Good Earth, for example. That is a beautiful place to visit just in the natural sense. And you could certainly go there and enjoy yourself and walk around and hike and enjoy the nature that's available there. But there's a story behind that area that has to do with, at the time, in the early 1600s or mid-1600s, this would have been the largest city in what's now the United States. And it was a trading center in pipe, stone, and in buffalo hides, and it was
Native American.
Mm-hmm. 6,000 to 10,000 people. So, it's a story that most people don't know about. If they know about something like that, they probably know about Cahokia.
Mm-hmm.
But most people don't know about Good Earth, and so seeing the film, the way it's set up, there's a visitor center. There's a theater with It's a dedicated theater. It just shows the film every 30 minutes, all day long.
Well, but that's great.
And so there's the film, and you walk out of that into a museum exhibit. And then when you walk out into the setting, you have the context. You understand what happened there. And it makes the whole experience so much more meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the purpose of any good visitor's film, is to give you context for the visit. What are you looking at? What does it mean?
And we had the privilege of working with five nations, five Native American nations, which was inspiring and challenging and something we will never forget. It was just wonderful.
In September, my wife, Jenny, and I had a chance to do this wonderful bike ride, and we were riding along the Danube, and we went to the tiny little museum in Willendorf. Now, if you don't know that, that's famous for the Venus of Willendorf, which is a small votive figure, like very, very ancient, thousands of years old, pre-Roman, so Venus has nothing to do. She was it was just a fertility votive, right?
Right.
And I see those films on a loop. And it's great if they're in, like, the museum is big enough that you kind of walk back and you go into the room or you might activate it. Well, this museum was so tiny. It was about as big as the studio that we're sitting in right now. So there was a young woman who was manning the front desk and taking the, you know, €4 to come in. And let's just say September is off season for Willendorf. And she's got a small child. She's trying to keep entertained. And I thought, oh, dear, she has to listen to that film on a loop.
Right.
So hopefully they give her, you know, volume control. And maybe she just, you know, had left it up a little bit.
I've had that thought about the people in the lobby at Good Earth.
But at least there's a little separation, hopefully.
A little
bit. That kind of thing.
Very little.
Well, the other great story that we haven't even gotten to yet, but we will before this time is done, is we'll talk about how you have elevated the long overdue attention deserves to be paid to Hero Street. So we'll get to that in just a moment. But right now, I just want to remind you that my guests are Tammy and Kelly Rundle from Fourth Wall Films. By the way, if I want to find out more about Fourth Wall Films online, where do I go?
You go to our website, fourthwallfilms.com.
That couldn't be easy.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
F-O-U-R-T.
That's right. Yes. That's right. And before we slide off into this week's Saturday Morning Jam, I did want to say thanks to everyone who's called in and made a pledge of support during this end of year fund drive. Our friend Amber is across the hall right now wondering why you don't give a call. 309-794-7500. You can also go online at wvik.org and make a pledge. But friends, your support is what makes radio like this possible. Radio that's accountable to its community, that tells stories, and as we're doing today, celebrates the storytellers. So please take a moment and become or extend your membership in this public radio station. So for this week's Saturday Morning Jam, it's a little bit of a down note, but I couldn't let it pass. We saw this week the passing of Steve the Colonel Cropper, who was one of the great studio musicians in the 1960s and 70s, who really climbed to fame. I had a chance to see a little bit of a documentary snippet about how the piece of music we're going to hear came together. And it was just friends being creative with each other. And the result, which I find fascinating, we do now in loving memory of Steve the Colonel Cropper, Green Onions, Booker T, and the MGs. Ah, the Colonel. Steve Cropper there, featured with Booker T and the MGs, Green Onions. Sad to see him go. And we're talking about film this morning with Kelly and Tammy Rundle. And before I go too much further, I will say that one of the most influential films in my life, don't look for anything deep, because I was only 15, but it was The Blues Brothers. I just have to say it. I mean, my aspiration was to go to Mount Prospect and get a surplus police car and just, you know, spend my next 10 years driving around in that. But of course, that's where most of us first met Steve Cropper. He's part of the Blues Brothers band. But right now, the band in question is Kelly and Tammy Rundle and Fourth Wall Films. And we do want to urge friends that if you've got just a moment, if you would mind going over to wvik.org or 309-794-7500 and making a pledge of support, that'll make all this goofy stuff possible. But I meant what I said before. Part of our role is to not just lift up the stories of our community, but the storytellers. So I grew up knowing some guys whose families were part of Hero Street. So I kind of knew about it, but it wasn't really celebrated until we started organizing around the monument. And then the folks from Hero Street really getting organized. At what point did you guys discover this story and start making movies about it?
It was when we moved here. We moved back in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading accounts in the newspaper related to the monument.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know what it meant.
And he grew up here. Mm-hmm. No excuse.
Yeah. Well, I went to United Township High School. Yeah.
Right.
Kids in my class were related to the heroes. I never heard about the story.
Mm-hmm.
So this is now almost 25 years later, I guess. And then we're hearing about it. But I still didn't know what it was. And then a friend from elementary school was going to be back in town and said, well, meet me at the VFW in East Moline. I didn't understand that, how that fit into the story either.
Mm-hmm.
And then behind the bar was Mark Wilson's book. And I realized, oh, there's a book. Got the book and immediately realized that was an important local history story, but also an important American history story.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what got us started on that journey. We couldn't find funding, just went out and began shooting material in 2012 on Memorial Day. And struggled with that until we had a partner in WQPT with an initial episode focused on one of the soldiers. We initially thought we'd do a feature length that would tell the story of all eight.
Mm-hmm.
But that film was really well received, got an Emmy nomination, and we thought, well, let's make it a more of a limited series and focus on each of those young men and their unique but sort of universal story.
And for folks who might be tuning in and are not familiar with it, there is a block stretch of a street in Silvis where you will find, I think, the greatest concentration. I'll say this, so if somebody wants to fight me and give me some data, I'll let them do it. But I don't think you'll find anywhere a more compact concentration of major medal winners, from the Congressional Medal of Honor to every imaginable honor for military service. And it was in like this basically block and a half section of a street that rolls up the top of the valley in Silvis. And it's an amazing story. And like you said, absolutely, Kelly, some of us grow up here and we don't even know all that story. So thank you for capturing it.
Well, I think, too, sometimes we discount our local history stories. I mean, every story that's important or well-known is local to someplace. So our stories are no less important. They may not be more important, but they're no less important.
Yeah.
When we were in Los Angeles, we talked about this often, that a lot of the documentaries, historical documentaries, focused on the coasts.
Of course.
And the stories of the coasts. And here we are living in Los Angeles, traveling back to our home, our heartland home, telling those stories, because there are so many below the surface. There are just so many amazing stories.
That's such a phenomenon. I mean, even in higher education, when I'm working at these national consortia, there are strips on either coast who don't understand that anything happens between the Appalachians and the Sierra Nevadas. I mean, they just don't get it, right? And when you drag them out here and you give them a chance to see what's going on, then they change their tune a little bit. And I will say, I don't know if you have ever heard of the Cervantes family, but not from East Moline, from Davenport, but Mike Cervantes for a long time was the head of our LULAC, League of United Latin American Citizens. And these three brothers all went off to war. And I got a chance to hear this from Mike, because the oldest brother, Bill, actually went to Augustana in the 30s, and he was a math major. So when the war came, he was made a navigator, an officer on a bomber in the South Pacific. And so all the boys were in combat, and it was a terribly fraught thing, I can only imagine, for their parents. But Mike had me, I had a chance to go to the new World War II Museum in New Orleans. And if you were to buy a commemorative brick, they made it clear, you know, you don't get to place where it is. We're just going to put it where it is. Well, so I went down there and spent an afternoon trying to find it. And I'll be doggone, all three Cervantes brothers, their bricks were right next to each other. Mm-hmm. And I assume that's still the case, even though that was about 10, 15 years ago. But I was able to bring a picture back to Mike. He's no longer with us. But there are so many stories like that I just have to wonder how we just stumble past them all the time.
Right. I mean, we've been married 45 years.
Yeah.
32 years we have worked together on these films, and we have produced 24 films. So to sit down and talk about them and give them, you know, the deep due they mm-hmm, deserve, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of hard to do that.
Well, but I know we're going to miss a lot, but let's not miss Gene Seberg. Uh-huh. How did you guys find out about that?
Well, we were living in Los Angeles and the phone rang, and it was Gary McGee who wrote a biography about Gene Seberg. And he had been working on a film project. He had gathered some interviews with really the first interviews that her family consented to.
And after her death. Yeah.
We talked about it and then hung up, and Tammy said, well, what did he want? And I said, I don't know. maybe he's looking for a co-producer on it. And that's where we ended up. After we made the move, we met Gary and talked about a way to complete the film together. And we came up with our own approach to new material we would shoot, incorporating his interviews and a kind of a different vision for what the film could be, and produced this 90-minute documentary about
Iowa actress Gene Seberg.
Yeah. And another great film. I got to see here locally, which brings me to an important question. For those of us or folks who are listening now who would like to see these films, what are some ways that people can access your work?
Well, they are shown annually here in the Quad Cities and in the region, of course, public kind of events, which we enjoy. And then all of our films are available to stream through our website. The service is called Vimeo, VIMEO.com. And so, and then, of course, they're all available on DVD and Blu-ray and so on. Yeah.
At fourthwallfilms.com.
See, right. There you go. Right. That's how you find it.
Tammy's our marketing director.
And if you're interested in Gene Seberg, we have a separate site for her, GeneSebergMovie.com as well as HeroStreetMovie.com.
Yeah. Well, I just wonder, I mean, you guys have done so much in the realm of good storytelling. And I don't want to pose this the wrong way, but you get to a point where you've got to start to be thinking of, well, there's only a certain number of more stories that we're going to have the bandwidth for. How does something get on that list? And is there something that maybe isn't officially on the list that you can tell us at least you're interested in?
I don't think there is. Our plate is pretty full right now. Something always seems to crop up.
Right.
We've got, we're in production or in pre-production or post-production on 5 different films right now. One of them that QC Pride and Memory got in touch with us, and we've been working on that gradually.
Tell us about that project, because it's a very important project.
It is a very important project.
Well, it'll tell the history of
project.
The history of the LGBTQ plus community here in the Quad Cities, and some really, really fascinating stories. Again, it's a local history story, though, that has ties to the national narrative.
So. Right. And where individuals bounce up against those stories is that the We Care Weekend was a time when the community, the LGBTQ community, was starting to reach and build bridges to those folks who are outside of that community and getting people together around the tragedy of AIDS. To document that one element, but I know that's only a tiny little facet, is going to be very valuable,
yes.
I think. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are some other ones that you want to... Maybe.
We're continuing work on our Hero Street. We're working on a Korean War hero, Joe Gomez, and we hope that'll be done next year.
Right.
And we're also working on an environmental film that we're wrapping up.
Yes, with a theme of overconsumption, sustainability. So this will be the fourth in a series of environmental films.
So it'll be a short one.
Mm-hmm. Had the privilege of working on.
Well, that's awesome.
Yes.
But you say these just kind of come to you. Is there something that's been more of a source than others, or is it really that happenstance?
Honestly, it seems like one thing leads to another often. it does feel often like the topics are choosing us rather than the other way around.
Well, I guess
we have a veto, but...
Yeah, that's right, of course. This is probably an unfair question based on all the territory that we've covered so far, but we're going to run out of time here in a minute. And I just wonder, do you have time for other kinds of media? Do you have any books you'd care to recommend to us that you've been reading recently, or maybe non-documentary films that you've enjoyed, or things like that?
Non-documentary? Well, the film about the making of the film Breathless that it focuses on Gene Seberg has been of special interest to us. So we certainly have taken an interest in that and enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah.
Nouvelle Vague. So check that out. But there are a couple of things about filmmaking in general. One is that I think Hitchcock was asked, well, what's the point of what you do in a film? Yeah. And he said, to put the audience through it. And I think we definitely do that. But our point also is to make the audience feel something. We're not just trying to reach somebody's head, but their heart. Because if you don't do that, they don't remember. And the story doesn't maybe have meaning for them. Also, Tammy and I have been through a traditional naming ceremony among the Iowa. And we were given the names Wagiche and Wagiche Mi. That's the male and female versions. It means speaks for them. And the elder who gave us the name said that the them... is not the present day Iowa, but their ancestors. Mm. And so we are advocates for the dead or for those whose voices are not being heard as they should be.
Right. And that's something that we need to be cognizant of. And what I tell students a lot when I get to work on projects with them, that the one question they always leave out in journalism school after the who, what, when, where, why, how is whom? To whom are you telling the story? Are you inviting them into the story, right? And I love your Hitchcock quote. One of my favorites is from the American poet Muriel Rukeyser, who said, "The universe is made not of atoms, but of stories."
Right.
And that's something that we have to keep in mind as we are interacting with the younger folks, folks who have never heard of Hero Street, perhaps, or anyone. That we have to keep these stories because, I mean, I think this is why the Ken Burns documentary right now about the Revolutionary War is so important. Is we have to remember that our country is a story.
Right.
Right. And it's up to us whether we which elements we are able to learn from and build upon. So
yeah, you can't know who you are or where you're going if you have no sense of your history.
Right.
Personal history, your state history, your national history.
Yeah. Well, listen, I am so grateful that you guys were able to spend some time here this morning, but I hate to tell you this, we're out of time. How did that happen? But once again, thanks to my guests this week, Kelly and Tammy Rundle from Fourth Wall Films. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, you
bet. It was wonderful talking with you.
Oh, and always fun talking with you, other than at a screening when everyone wants to talk to you at the same time. But today, friends, would be a good day to go to that website and check some things out because not a great day to be outside. We got some snow likely before midnight tonight. Otherwise, chilly, high around 28. Tomorrow, 20% chance of snow before noon. Then mostly cloudy, gradually becoming sunny. Temp only going to hit about 23 degrees. And for now, we just want to remind you that ahead, it's WVIK's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Then join us next week when our guest will be Dr. Mark Safestrom. That'll be right here on Saturday Morning Live. Portions recorded. You can find our podcast at WVIK.org or tune in to Quad Cities NPR, WVIK 90.3 FM. Make a pledge now, WVIK.org.